Hey everyone, co-host Topper here with a scheduling update. For the next four episodes, we are going to be releasing every 2 weeks. That means episode 9, the season finale of Night Probe, will be out April 13th, followed by the first Pit Stop bonus episode on the wacky world of Mac Bolan on April 27th. If all goes according to plan, we'll have a Pit Stop episode from Nancy on May 11th, and the first episode of Pacific Vortex will be out May 25th, at which point we will resume our usual weekly schedule. We thank you all from the bottom of our hearts for listening to the first year of this little podcast and having fun with us as we experiment with ways to keep it interesting and entertaining.
Famed author Clive Cussler.
The hero, Dirk Pitt.
Danielle began to lose control. Deck at 5,000 feet. We have enough for 3 more hours flying time. And then he came down on top of it.
Night Probe, Episode 8. Muck Fuckled.
65.
Good for you. That's what it is here.
And we're due for snow on Wednesday.
Enjoy every illness that will bring you.
You closed my window. What the... God, I hate my cat.
Oh, yeah. That shows.
She's like, well, I'm just going to walk across this keyboard, which feels so nice on my toes.
You know, it probably does. I haven't thought about it that way. Now you've made a case for the cat.
It probably does. My cat is stimming.
Everyone stims.
How are you doing?
Pretty good. I've,
Okay, you're biting me now.
I was thinking about marketing, and I was, for the one of the podcasts I wanted to buy the marketing on, and for instance, they talk about another podcast, and they say, these two atheists got together, and they're raising children. Doing it atheist style. So it's like down to 3 sentences, and you get like the gist of the podcast.
Okay.
I like your banter thing, but I think it's so long. It's not bad. It's just, that's like a limousine, and we are in a Honda Civic.
I was aiming for one of the 30-second ads that you see on a lot of, or that you hear on a lot of other podcasts.
Yeah, so I was trying to distill it down to like 2 or 3 sentences, which is way harder than you think.
No. Really biting with it. Anyway.
Did she draw blood?
A little bit.
Oh, okay. Maybe she's done with you now. If she takes her paw and marks her forehead with your blood, then she's done.
She'll be back in 5 minutes, and she will want to sit right here and do the exact same thing. And if I move in the slightest, she'll fuck me up again. This is what she does. See, she's coming back already. She wants to sleep on me on her terms only.
And how did we not name our podcast The Pit Stop?
That's pretty good. Damn. I don't know. This was your idea.
I was brainstorming, and I was like, God damn it. That's a much better name.
I had the Dirk Pitt cast, which I was like, yeah, it's fine. And then you had Cussler Hustlers, which I was against. And then I thought of it over the weekend and I was like, damn, that's so much better than mine, actually.
We were both wrong.
Back to the keyboard.
And I've got...
There's going to be so much cat in this episode. Yeah, back on the lap now. Okay. I have to edit this so it makes sense.
The Hero is an Asshole is the title I came up with.
I do like branching out like in between books for a few episodes, do something new. And the one that I've already begun researching, have you ever heard of Mac Bolan?
No.
The Executioner?
Was he England's last executioner?
Mac Bolan, it's a series of manly adventure novels, short novels, starring Mac Bolan, who's called the Executioner because he's a really successful sniper. And he sort of does the A-team thing of going town to town solving problems.
Oh, Kung Fu.
There are 464 mainline Mac Bolan Executioner novels, and 178 Super Bolan novels, which are twice as long. These were released monthly for decades.
Then we need a title, like, because when we examine these books and we talk about them and like how they relate to present day, also in the light of history, if we need a title that's more, not now, we will stick with Cussler Hustlers until we get past the main Dirk Pitt stories, but like more like, why do we need a hero?
Mm-hmm.
So we could examine any work of fiction. And we could do the Cussler thing where we're like, oh, we're doing a Cussler block. Then when we're done, we can pivot to another thing.
Regarding the title, I'm kind of two minds of that. A rebrand might help widen the audience. On the other hand, Ill James Bond, they're done all the Bond movies. They're on, I guess, season 3 now. And they're not doing Bond movies, but it's still called Kill James Bond. Although that is a title that really does strike you.
That really does. It's a very evocative title. That's like...
That is a bit broader than Cussler Hustlers.
There was two paint stores across the street from one another, and one was Main Street Paints, and the other one was Art Attack. Which one?
Good point.
So, because we talk about how these things affect culture, and how mm-hmm. What is it about that us that we need one singular guy that's the hero?
Well, you do, at least. I feel I tend to focus on, like, how is this historically accurate? What was happening at the time?
Yeah, you always bring the homework. Always. You always do all of the homework and the obscure shit.
And you're more talking about, like, how it affected the culture, the more intangible aspects. You have better insights there than I do. Because I didn't really start paying attention until, like, 2013?
Neither did I.
He made up that gun. That's a fake gun.
It's the yin and the yang.
You're blocking the microphone. I don't even know if they can hear me now. Look how small my lines are.
She really did baffle your sound.
Speaking into a cat muffler. Okay, now she's gone. Obviously not going to do a book review of all 464 Mac Bullen novels, but I'm researching the concept of them, and I figure I'll listen to a few of the audiobooks because there's hundreds of them on YouTube, and they're half as long as a regular book.
Oh, okay.
And I'm fascinated by this weird series that, like, the first 30 were written by one guy, and then they took off, and then that was back in the days where they just, well, not even back in the days, it was the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Where they just hired ghostwriters. They all used the same name of Dan Pendleton and just churned out a new one every month.
The Carolyn Keene did. It was Nancy Drew books or...
Hardy Boys, all those.
Hardy Boys was the same thing. It was the same office, I think, as the Carolyn Keene books. Might have been the same dude.
And I just want to know how they got 464 novels of the same guy going town to town solving crimes and mysteries.
At some point, it's just Tex-Mex. Either you have the Gordito or the Tostita or the Taco... But it's all the same ingredients, just layered differently.
Oh, you have the formula down. I don't doubt that there's a Bible that these authors had to, like, absolutely stick to. Do not deviate from these eight things have to happen.
Never kill the dog. If the girl has to die, she has to be a slut.
Also research I'm doing, because I'm trying to write my own Dirk Cussler-esque short novel. And trying to hit all the same beats and hit all the same points, but...
I don't think you have the deep misogyny within you.
But that's just
it. I think there's fundamental building blocks that you just don't have.
But also doing it my way. So hitting all the main blocks.
You're a man with daughters, and you can't.
Exactly. My character is going to be completely oblivious at the random women throwing themselves at him. He's focused on the mystery.
Or he'll be like, and he hired a secretary, and it was a competent woman of middle age.
All right.
All right. We should get the energy up.
We should get started. I realized last week, this joke might be a week late, because last week, technically, I was supposed to do the intro, but then you did it, and it was so great, and I didn't want to step on your toes.
Oh.
But I have to take advantage of the internet trends. So, welcome to Cussler Hustlers, the world's only Clive Cussler podcast that is brought to you by...
Welcome, Cerveza Cristal.
I don't know if you saw the Cerveza Cristal memes.
The memes were now Mike Pence isn't endorsing Donald Trump because Trump tried to... that's the meme land I'm in now. So explain this meme, as I'm sure it will live through time like the Macarena.
Footage surfaced of the Star Wars broadcast on a TV station in Chile in the early 2000s. They inserted beer commercials into the movie. At the start of the movie, when Obi-Wan is talking to Luke and... Obi-Wan says, "Your father wanted you to have this." And then he hands Luke a Cerveza Cristal beer and the song plays.
Wow, that is brilliant. And also, wow, copyright infringement.
And that happens all throughout the movies. Like, Darth Vader draws a Cerveza Cristal for his final showdown.
That's a commitment to a joke.
That was...
good for them.
Insane. And suddenly, Cerveza Cristal... was just being inserted into every other meme on the internet for a week straight. That made me happy. It was so dumb. I miss TV commercials. Do you remember when TV commercials were interesting and a thing? And you couldn't skip them, so they had to be good?
Yeah, and if you recorded something...
you recorded that ad forever.
Like my old landlady did until right up until she died. Even though she was blind as a bat, she was watching TV via Braille. I don't know why she wanted to watch so many... she liked game shows. So I guess you could just hear them.
But yeah,
those commercials were great because they were recorded for posterity. So you go back and you watch them years later and you're like, what? What were we doing?
I want to get this done in two more episodes.
Yes. We can almost plow through to the...
That by my math, we can get through 15 chapters today. So 59 to 74.
Let me recap 58 because I have a joke.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's a bad one. Fossglide takes his hydroplane and he runs into the side of a vessel, atomizing himself, or he becomes naval jelly. And there we go. Chapter 59.
Naval jelly a thing, or?
Naval jelly? Oh, yeah. It's a Russian mover. It's like old-timey okay. Russian mover.
I haven't heard of that.
Hold one second.
I hear a dog. Listeners, the dog is losing their shit, and Nancy is going to go deal with it. Dogs are super inconsiderate of personal time. Dogs are not allowed to become notary publics.
Sorry, the dogs picked a moment to stand by my window and bark.
These new microphones are great. I got to hear every
yes,
detail of my daughter making noodles in the kitchen. If I took off my headphones, I couldn't hear her. If I put the headphones on, I could hear her just fine.
Send us more, Rode, if you'd like to.
I'll need one for travel.
But you know who won't need one? Heidi. She's got a broken leg.
Yeah, she's got a broken leg, but that does not stop her from getting more action in these chapters than almost anybody else. But we'll get there. I was going to say, by the look on your face, I might have read further than you.
nothing is... Oh, no, I have read. I've been in a cast that was from like ankle to just below the knee. And it feels so gross to be stuck in a cast. And this lady's getting action. First, she must still be high on the painkillers. They must not have... We don't have this type of painkiller anymore. Whatever she's getting made her feel fantastic. This is the kind of stuff they gave NFL players when you broke your thigh? Here you go. Get back out there.
Yep, this was back where they gave you the bottle of opioids and say, come back for more. I mean, that's now from what I hear in the States and parts of Canada. I just think it was better because everybody was goofy.
I try to convey that because my daughter's learning about the founding fathers like more in depth than little kid stuff. Just keep in mind, they were all assholes because they were all like under 30. She doesn't get that. That concept is also, they were all drunk the entire time. That's history. Everybody was drunk or high. Even Queen Victoria. She was drinking her poppy tea and talking down the alcohol. She was like, oh, temperance is best. Meanwhile, she was in the clouds with her poppy tea.
Those early days in America when rum and whiskey was cheaper than milk.
And they wouldn't kill you. The milk would kill you.
Yeah, that's just it. Oh, hell yeah. The rum and the whiskey were antiseptic. They were medicinal.
So Heidi's got her broken leg. It's not in the cast yet. She's being carried off. Dirk gently brushes hair, her bangs out of her eyes. And she says she wouldn't have missed it for all the world. What? What? Why?
I'm glad I was here for this magic. After she's already blamed herself for everyone's death.
Many people are dead. She doesn't know the state of her leg at this point. She was exploded.
Is it?
Her leg is broken. That's a scary thing. If it's at an angle, I'd be freaking out. The screaming would never stop. These people handle trauma a lot better than us. Or a lot better than me.
Well, they gave her some whiskey.
They always do.
Heidi's being airlifted out. They got reports that a gym suit was floating downriver. They talked to the people on the Sappho who were going crazy because they forgot to turn on their CO2 scrubbers. So they're just like hallucinating and going, we're having fun down here as pink elephants and stuff.
Yes, I love that.
So Pitt tells them to turn on the CO2 scrubbers, you freaking idiots. And he's like, oh, that sounds like a good idea. And then just more death.
Have you ever scuba dived? Or
No, I barely even snorkeled.
Okay. The thought of like being silly poisoned by CO2 while in it. Oh, it's so creepy. It made my teeth feel fuzzy. Oof.
There was a short video by Jason Pardon in the last couple of days talking about one of the scariest photos ever. And it was a boat off the coast of Nigeria that was hit with a rogue wave. Boat flipped over and sank almost immediately. Everybody was declared dead. They send down divers to get the bodies out, and they find a guy who's been down there in an air pocket for 3 days, and the air pocket is really almost gone when they find him.
It was so much longer than 3 days. It was like 3 weeks.
They said it was 68 hours when the diver found him. This might be a different story.
A different one. Okay.
But it was 3 days, and he was rescued, and he was fine. He was the only survivor. A year later, his car goes off a bridge and flips, and he has to get rescued from the car. And he decides that he has a connection with the ocean, and he becomes a rescue diver and has like a long rescue diving life after that.
That's beautiful.
I wouldn't go in the water.
I wouldn't look at the water again.
But he's like, nope, I've been through this. Nobody else should. And he becomes like a world famous rescue diver.
You're diving. You're wearing goggles. You have no... And these characters have no peripheral vision. That guy was just in the dark. Not in an air pocket, not knowing if help will come for an interminable amount of time.
He had no food and one bottle of Coke, and it was salt water, so he couldn't drink anything else.
I wouldn't be able to speak English. I would have forgotten all of my words. The brain damage would have been profound. Good for it. That is a strong person. But the as Clive, I almost said as Dirk has written it. Dirk didn't write this. As Clive has written this, Klinger has the CO2 poisoning, and that just became a delightful extra level of horror that Clive put in there, and I appreciate that.
Yeah. They had to have something to balance off how weird the rest of this chapter is, because Pitt gets a radio call from someone named Collins, and he doesn't know who that is, so he's just a dick to this guy on the radio while Collins is like saying, could somebody rescue me, please?
Yes.
And the captain has to tell him that Collins is one of the guys in the gym suits, and he's buried in the silt, and he's asking to be rescued before his air runs out. And Pitt's like, oh, my bad.
I love that, because that's so human. Every once in a while, Clive does something that makes Dirk human. Like, he's nice to the old people and eats them mystery meat. And this is another case of he's just blundering into it like an asshole, like a regular person would. He's out of patience. He hasn't slept. He's not making the sharpest decisions. He's like, who is this Collins guy? Like the guy in the moon who didn't get off the Apollo 11?
Yeah, they point out that he's too stressed out to be like the unflappable leader right now. Like he's at his limit. He's a dick and he's screwing up. I kind of appreciated that.
Yes, and we've not seen that before.
But also Collins, because of where he was buried, they think he's on the bottom of the ship now. And Collins finds some bones and a skull that has $4,000 in gold teeth in it. And it turns out he found Harvey Shields. He got blown all the way through the boat to exactly where Harvey Shields and the North American Treaty are.
Speed of plot is a heck of a thing.
Pitt's mood improved.
Also, the way he goes about describing... First, Collins is either a dentist or a gold assayist, because he's like, I see two skulls between them, $4,000 in gold in the teeth. Okay, that's really on the nose in particular when you're half buried in a mech suit while underwater. But good for it. That's...
Accuracy is important.
Some people are always perceptive. And Clive Cussler describes the skull as two large rabbit teeth inside in the upper center surrounded by gold caps. And I'm like, what is that description? Is that an AI jumbled Amazon misprinted this? Because teeth aren't in a circle surrounded by other teeth.
I think the visual worked for him, and it was just to get across that most of the upper teeth are fake, but it was weirdly phrased, and I was picturing some sort of half-rabbit monster.
Yes.
Which would have made this interesting.
The skull had two large rabbit teeth. Okay. When were we told that before?
I guess that means the buck teeth were real and the rest were fake.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Not actual rabbit teeth, just like Bucky. I was like, well, damn, people did weird things for denture substitutes. Medical history is littered with whack jobs and who knows what. Dental history even more so. And then we get to chapter 60. Prime Minister Servoz is being briefed by Shaw, kind of against his will.
Shaw is everywhere.
And Shaw is telling him about Henry Vallon's traitory. And Prime Minister Servoz is like, can you just leave? I don't want to hear this. These accusations are outrageous. And then he makes Shaw leave. And he calls Commissioner Harold Finn. And is this a nautical joke, Harry Finn?
Possibly.
But he's the commissioner, and I cannot hear the word commissioner without thinking of The Commish, which was a show with Michael Chiklis.
Ah, I love that
Everyone
show.
Go back and watch that. It was delightful. It was a romp.
That was back-to-back with Picket Fences. That was like my go-to TV for a certain period in my life. Watched a lot of Copaganda as a kid.
I loved Picket Fences. I was like, I want to live in this. Mm-hmm. Why can't Tom Skerritt be my dad? And Don Cheadle got his start there.
Really?
Yeah.
Good for him.
He was a baby.
I don't remember that at all.
If you saw him, he looks like a zygote on it. Because you know Don Cheadle today. But as you look that up,
I was just going to say, was it Don Cheadle? Yeah.
We are on a picket fences tangent.
Actually, it's not even picket fences. It's a Golden Palace tangent. Do you remember Golden Palace?
No, that I must. I didn't have cable.
The Golden Girls spinoff, where the Golden Girls basically work at a hotel?
No.
That was Don Cheadle's first role. And the video of him getting into an argument with Rose over the fact that the Confederate flag is actually racist was his first role on TV.
I've got to make a note.
That video went viral a couple of years ago. He's like, as just celebrating my pride and my heritage. And he's like, actually, that flag's mostly about slaves. And my grandpa was one of them. It's a great scene.
Yep. Designing women was great for the scenes like that, too.
I know I saw that. I think that was when I was too young to know what the hell anything was going on. I was just happy to watch TV.
Oddly comforting, because your parents might have been laughing. They're like, oh, we're doing it together.
We're bonding, yay.
Meanwhile, this is not the commish or Michael Chiklis that...
No, this is just a
the
random...
Prime Minister is calling. He's calling...
RCMP Commissioner.
Yes. And he's like, oh, what happened when Greer died? Give me the lowdown. His driver and guard. Is he a trustworthy man? And he's trustworthy, Harry Finn says, because yes, he's got no arrest record. He's got a great service record. His two grown daughters, both married, earnest wage earners. So naturally, that's all the qualifications you need. That's the checklist.
It is.
And this man is unassailable. His daughters are married to men.
I wrote down that apparently Jacques Garrier had Mr. Burns syndrome because the RCMP guy says that he had everything from emphysema to gallstones. And he was like on death's door for the last 20 years. Where there's no way he would have died. He was too strong-willed. Like, I'm not sure that actually saves you from being sick with everything.
Yeah, I think death can happen even if you're really... I mean, Patton died from a car rolling over.
Well, that's why he died. He just didn't want to live hard enough.
You know, I like the victim blaming. It seems very puritanical, and it appeals to my American sensibilities. Shame. Shame.
I was raised by a cop. Me too. But I did have some notes in here for one brief tangent that actually is kind of on topic. So when Sarvo's talking to Shaw, they're talking about how Canada is still not fully independent from the UK. And the issue with that is, so this book came out in August 1981, and I keep forgetting this, and it blows my mind all the time. But Canada technically did not become fully independent until March of 82.
You were alive?
The Canada Act, which was our constitution, was approved by British Parliament on 1982 and proclaimed by Queen Elizabeth on April 17th, making Canada wholly independent when I was a year and a half old.
So we had to wait till Soap Dish came on the air before the Brits would get out of Canada?
Yeah. So when this book came out, we were a British property, but like less than a year after this book came out, we weren't. And that's why, as far as I can tell, they never bring up the fact that Canada belongs to the United States ever again, because because Clive was like, well, shit, that doesn't make sense now.
Yeah,
But I just love how, I love how close that was, and I can't believe how recent it was.
So he missed like the mark, he slid under by like 9 months.
Yeah, so I'm wondering if it was in the news when he was writing this book that there were rumblings that Canada was finally separating from the UK, and he's like, I'm gonna write that into my story. But it went the wrong way.
It still went good for him. He still got the book out there. It was on the shelves, it was in the airports, he got the sales.
Each of these books has had like either a major plot or a major subplot that related to what was happening in the news at that moment. Just, he put his twist on it.
He was prescient in a lot of things. Not everything. He takes a lot of swings.
He does, and God bless him for it.
And speaking of TV, the driver, who's unassailable, remember, his daughters are married. The driver guard guy, Jean, says Henry Villon was there the night Greer was killed. I have been fighting this. We're just calling him Greer now. He's the cheese.
I was going to say, that's cheese.
And it doesn't make any sense. It sounds crazy. How could have Henry Villon had been there the night Greer was killed? Henry Villon was on TV at the exact same time, 1,000 miles away. So many Columbo episodes hinge on this premise here. of
Well, that's impossible.
I'll just play the voice recording and continue narrating this nature film and just walk into the other room and stab Mighty Secretary. I couldn't have done it. I was narrating the nature film or the magic act or Hamlet. So it was used at least 3 times.
I have to watch more Columbo.
I recommend the show on Paramount Plus with... I'll get there. We'll circle back to that when I remember it. No, it was on Peacock. It's the new Columbo.
New Columbo?
It is.
I found the article saying Poker Face is the new Columbo.
That's the one. That's it.
Ooh, Rian Johnson. All right.
It's got a delightful cast. It is like Columbo in that they have like stars that are way out of caliber, too high caliber for guest appearing on these shows.
I was going to say, that looks like Natasha Lyonne, and it is. So it's a Rian Johnson cop show based on Columbo with Natasha Lyonne. I am down. That is like 4 things I want.
It is spectacular, and it's zero calorie. Like, you won't feel bad. It's delightful. You'll just end it and you'll be like, oh.
Well,
it's like bubblegum.
I am writing that one down.
They're calling Jean or Jean's testimony bizarre and unhinged. You could not have seen Henry Villon. He is like, motherfuckers, give me the truth serum. Give me the hypnosis. Give me a lie detector test. Give me the whole yama yama of truthiness. Truthiness, TM, Stephen Colbert. Don't let that word die. Truthiness. More important now than ever. Truth serum was such a fixture of the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
Sodium pentothal. It just does not do what it says. People said it did.
It lowers your inhibitions and makes it harder for you to tell lies because it screws with your imagination. You can't put things together unless they're real. So you'll try and make shit up and accidentally tell the truth. But it also causes you to tell just complete gibberish because you're putting a bunch of shit together that doesn't necessarily fit.
And also, you might be telling the truth according to you and your biochemistry. You're saying the truth, but it could be disjointed hallucinations.
But there's the truth and the truth.
It wasn't Mythbusters, but it was some show where they did I'm not sure if it was sodium pentothal because that was like a controlled substance, but they did stuff with truth serums and they had people rehearse a lie and then get interrogated with truth serum and the rehearsed lie worked. So if you've really got the lie down good, it'll hold up under truth serum.
Well, they say that about lie detector tests. Hypnosis, I don't think anybody truly believes in that. That's a parlor trick. The lie detector test is still used by law enforcement to intimidate people. Famously in New York City, they hooked some guy up to a Xerox copy machine when these things first came out and said it was a lie detector test. They attached him to strings. Silly propaganda stuff. But total like tea leaves. But he passes all of these tests, so science. He's telling the truth.
He says it was Villon, but it can't be Villon. So we're ending our investigation.
And the prime minister's like, you know what? We have to exhume the body. He tells Harry Finn. And Harry Finn's like, oh, that could be getting an exhumation order. That could be tricky. And prime minister's like, don't get an order. Just do it.
Am I the prime minister or not?
I have looked into exhumations because I am a white woman.
I knew this podcast would become true crime before long.
A true, yes. And it's like tree law. Some places, really strict. Like, you touch that tree, you try and move that body, you're going to go to jail. No one, your family won't know where you are. You're just missing. Other places, it's like, meh, whatever you want.
Here, have a corpse.
And your neighbor's fruit tree.
You had a lot more notes for this chapter. And I'm starting to get a little worried because we're 52 minutes in and we're 2 chapters through this section.
Oh, yeah. And last thing, Finn has an awkward moment because the boss tells him, so how long have you known my wife's been having an affair?
That was my major note for this chapter.
I'm a federal employee. I don't want to get in the middle of your business. This happened to me when I found out one of my bosses was having an affair. And I got a very nice promotion package.
Ooh.
And more vacation days. It was... So sometimes in books you have hypotheticals, like, what would I do? I know what I would do. I would blackmail somebody.
But in the end, the RCMP guy says, we've known for 2 years. Sorry, goodbye.
Yeah, he's like, oh, so awkward. You know, it's private stuff. If you knew, and I knew, oh, never mind. Then we go into chapter 61. Dirk's still standing upright. The death toll is 12 dead, one missing for the Ocean Venturer crew.
This is one of the first times where Pitt actually jumps into the action himself, because he dons a scuba suit, he gets some spare oxygen, and he goes to get the North American Treaty, because we're not going to have some B-plot bit character do this.
Yes, and he's fortunately encounters an adult with a Rudy gun, and Rudy's like, oh god, oh, fine, I'm exhausted too, but I guess I'll monitor your dive so you don't die.
Rudy Gunn is his bones. Rudy Gunn is the person who's on his shoulder going, Dirk, you're being stupid. Stop it.
He does all of Dirk's emotional labor. He even Clive Cussler does. He does all the unseen things that need to be done that nobody does.
Al is the one who goes, that's stupid, I'm in. And Rudy's the one who goes, that's stupid, be smarter. Yin and the yang.
So, yeah.
Actually, maybe that makes Rudy Gunn the Spock. Because it's the Spock Bones Kirk triad. We have Kirk who wants to go do the insane stupid thing, Spock who's like, slow down, and Bones being the one who insists that he thinks about it, but also like he processes the emotions properly.
It sounds Bonesy, because this is a caretaking role, more so than Spock's.
Yeah, that's true.
Analytical.
Maybe it doesn't quite work here.
Dirk dives, and he sees in the Empress of Ireland wreckage skeletons, and they're kind of beige, not bleached white, like you see in the movies.
They're brown. They're mucky.
And when I was in high school, we had a real skeleton that was donated many years before. And our biology teacher was telling us about it and how we should treat it with care. And it's an honor to have a real skeleton in our biology class, that we've had it for so long. And a girl raised her hand. And we were all 14. This was freshman year. Raised her hand. She's like, you've had this for how long? Does that mean the skeleton was just a baby when you got it?
basic biology.
The teacher looked like he made every wrong decision in life at that moment. He was like, what did you just ask me?
Just shut down as he tries to figure out how to answer this without being insulting.
No, he went full insulting.
Okay.
He destroyed her.
That could have gone one of two ways.
No. Meanwhile, Pitt is becoming the Little Mermaid. He's coming across all this flotsam and jetsam. He finds a matchbook and a little decanter of medicine underwater that's still sealed. And he's like, look, the medicine's still in it. He's getting a little loopy. He's going through jagged openings and getting micro cuts on his suit. He's leaving trails of blood everywhere. He's not fully aware of his surroundings at this point.
He's got like hypothermia because he can't feel his skin. He like jams his finger. He cuts himself. He's bleeding everywhere. His suit's all shredded. And he's like, nope, must find North American Treaty for some reason.
Yes. And he, at this point, I'm like,
must do what President says.
Can't you just make your own North American Treaty? This is like, how come we didn't find the yellow kick in Iraq? If it was me and I was on the hook for that, I would have been like, look, here it is. Even if I had to get my guys to make it. I'm not ethical. Apparently, just make your own document. Do you have old paper?
I think the whole reason they can't do that is because if they do that, they still don't know where the copy owned by the Canadians is. And the Canadians will come out with, hey, we have the real copy right here. Yours is a fake.
Just try before 12 people die. Try forgery before you try something that causes mass death.
Well, yes.
So, yes, he's also brooding like the Little Mermaid under there. He's like, oh, maybe I should stay under here. He's having an existential crisis. And yeah, he does find a muck-covered pocket.
Name of the episode. Can you write that down?
Sure thing. This pocket is the oracloth. It's the treaty. He found the treaty, and he brings it up carefully in the water of the St. Lawrence River. And then they hop to chapter 62 to do some fast archaeology.
I was going to say, chapter 62 is also one of the ones I can kind of sum up in one or two sentences. So it's the coroner who's staring at the corpse of Jules Guerrier while eating a deviled egg sandwich, because every coroner, to prove just how unflappable they are, has to eat something gross while dealing with a corpse.
And yes, it is a trope. But I like Abner.
But he finally finds that Guerrier's mouth is full of...
We never get Abner's.
Never get who?
Abner's. When's the last time you heard the name Abner? So never mind. It's a point not important. But I was like, oh, an Abner. And he's going, life does not cease without reason. This really hinges on your definition of the word reason. Because he's inspecting Greer's body. And he's like, oh, he had to die of something. But not this, not that. And he finds cosmetics on the gums. that hid the petechia, which is the discoloration from when you're smothered. And he was like, of course, this makes sense. The teeth marks were on the pillow. Dude.
They weren't sure what to make of the teeth marks on the pillow, but now it all makes sense.
The order of operations here, this sentence comes first in the investigation.
Our police are not very smart.
They needed to exhume the body?
Let's do it again, I guess. At the very end of it, he calls Sarvo and they have a conversation. And Sarvo comes to the unthinkable conclusion that maybe Vallon and the FQS are one and the same. Maybe Vallon is in charge of the FQS. But why would he hire a killer like Foss Bly? If you think he's the head of a terrorist organization, why would he hire a terrorist? Seems like a pretty...
A to B.
I still don't think Sarvo is right in his head, because he's... You say that what he's doing makes sense. I think that he's just a complete idiot every step of the way here.
I think he's casually evil. Like, he's regretful.
It's like reverse speed of plot. Like, he is one step behind all the clues being given to him just so he keeps doing what he's doing, pushing to keep Canada together while everybody else is trying to tear Canada apart.
Yes. He is coming across as that, but he's like the misty-eyed bad guy. He's like, oh.
Mm-hmm. He meant well.
Yes. The road to hell and all that.
But then he was blown up. His wife left him. He's not going to win.
His wife is cheating on him.
Oh, okay, good point.
He leaves his wife.
Emotionally left him. His country's falling apart. He's not going to win re-election. He's like, oh, everything's going bad for Sarvo.
And he knows that this treaty is being pursued left and right.
Mm-hmm.
It's stress from all sides for him, and he's trying to make monumental world leadery decisions.
Sarvo just can't win.
And then we go to chapter 63. Pitt is topside with the box, and we find out that they're going to do some fast archaeology now. Not in the last chapter, now they are.
Mm-hmm.
They rush it to the boat docks of Brooklyn to find Dr. Galasso. So 1982, if there was an archaeologist in Brooklyn, I'm a giraffe, but okay.
I think that's just where they were meeting him, maybe.
Yeah. And I don't think people of that kind of educational caliber were allowed in the borough. But they do some tense archaeological stuff with the document. Clive is trying to write this so you're on the edge of your seat, but it's over the course of hours. Because nothing about taking a document and opening it when it's been submerged is going to be fast. This is going to take days.
I know.
We've unfolded it. Now it has to rest for 7 hours.
We don't have days. We have hours. They cut through the luggage. They remove the oil skins. They do all this tent stuff with scalpels and chemicals and stuff and trying to make sure that everything stays hydrostatically stable. But the treaty is goo.
Yeah. Treaty full of mush. Make your own people.
Everything on the St. Lawrence was for nothing. 12 dead people. Busted up Heidi. A boat go kaboom. A few boats go kaboom.
Yeah. Poor Heidi. We meet her again in part 5, and she's on a plane.
Part 5, The Manhattan Limited, May 89, chapter 64.
Yes. So she's on a plane with a cast that goes from her ankle to her thigh, which has got to be. She's a tall girl, too, so that's got to be pure agony. Then Shaw has the audacity to come and sit next to her. This guy.
He's everywhere.
Practically ruined her career.
Mm-hmm.
She would never have a security clearance again.
Because he apologizes to her, and she blames him for the death of a dozen men, and like breaking her leg, and ruining her career, and causing all this international chaos, and then ends her tirade by saying, "You stink."
Measured response.
The worst insult she can come up with. And that just, like, that fell so flat for me. It just, You were on a tear. Like, she was right this whole time, and then she just ends it with, "You stink," and then she looks out the window. All right.
I'd be awkward, too. Like, what if we were alive at the time of Pol Pot? You were, say you're 20-something or 32, and you're on a plane, and he sits next to you. There's no vocabulary that could be justifiable that rises to the occasion of the vitriol that you would need to pump out. I would be so bad at it.
That's true. Shaw does come back and says, "It wasn't me that did, like, all the killing. That was Foss Gly." And Heidi doesn't know who that is because no one tells her anything.
Yeah. And then he's like...
At this point, she doesn't know who Foss Gly is.
And then he's like, "You have to get a message to the president." And she goes, I can't. Nobody's going to patch me through to the president. I'm just Commander Mulligan. I'm Heidi. And he goes, "No, I get that. Just call his national security advisor." And she goes, oh, yeah, that's cool.
Alan Mercy, eh?
She'll be able to cut right through the bullshit there.
Oh, that, yeah.
That's one phone call, right?
I'm sure all Americans know each other.
And
at the very end of it, Shaw's the one who says, if you take over Canada, it'll be the end of NATO and the breakdown of world peace. And Heidi's response is, why would America try to take over Canada?
Oh.
What the fuck do you think you were doing this whole time? The last 30 chapters have been specifically to find this treaty so your country can take over Canada.
She thought her PhD thesis was really important, and all of these newer vessels
Boy,
were...
everyone's really into finding this letter. I'm popular.
What kind of perspective did she think was happening? Like, what did she... It's not important. Heidi, get yourself together. But then we go, chapter 65, Pitt and Al are back together. It's happy times. Pitt wants to know why the bridge failed. And Moon tells Pitt they need this treaty ASAP because the president's going to... In 4 days, the president's going to speak in Canada, and he wants to, you know, kind of wrap this up and use this as a bow to join forces.
At 1 p.m. Monday, he addresses Parliament. After that, don't bother.
The chemist they meet with says the bridge sample that they brought in, this was blown up. It wasn't, it didn't collapse, wasn't hit by something and sheared. It was systematically blown up.
Evidence of iron sulfide.
And then we never go back to that chemist again. He's dead to us.
Yep, he's just there for one chapter. And chapter 66 is, it's not quite a parlor scene, it's a history scene.
Yes, but I imagine everyone's wearing velvet.
Oh, God, yeah.
And there's dark drapery, a chandelier.
Pitt is drinking with Beatty. Have we met Beatty before?
Professor Beatty? It feels like he's come up before. I can't swear to it.
All right.
But they're in, comes across as like a tour guide historian.
And they're in a bar built on a building where the hotel owners killed the guests and then served them to the other guests. And like you said earlier, I looked into this and it's real.
Yes, I almost looked into this. I was like, oh, it's Sweeney Todd, the Bloody Benders. But this Pilcher's Inn was real in Poughkeepsie.
Yep. Pilcher's Inn in Poughkeepsie, located on Albany Road. And they were only found out because in 1845, accompanying the captain on his journey to New York was a servant whom the good captain had picked up on the island of Fiji in the South Pacific. Man and boy sat down at the Pilcher's table and ordered bowls of stew. The Fijian boy remarked that while he recognized beef, he also recognized the taste of long pig, which his mother had prepared for them. And the Fijians in the 1800s were known to be cannibals. And this got to the captain and it got to the cops and they were like, I think they're serving people there. And they actually were. He recognized the taste of people. What a weird piece of actual history that Clive just shoehorns into this chapter. Because this doesn't come back either.
That is so gory.
Yep.
Oh, that is blood-drippingly gory. But then we move on to the delightful, but we drop the Sweeney Todd Bloody Benders pictures in story. We go to the first bad guy of the story, Clement Massey, the guy who robbed the train station, Dapper Doyle.
Mm-hmm.
We find out he was a state senator and a bandit.
Yep. But first he was a bandit, and then he was a senator, and in the period in between, some stuff happened.
Oh, he went to Harvard.
Oh, yeah, well, that's important. This is when they find out that the Manhattan Limited, which I keep wanting to call the Manhattan Express or the Express Limited, I'm never going to get those three words right.
That's okay. I will never spell Halloween right. I just, some things you have to come to terms with.
There's $2 million in gold coins on the train.
Yes, and the reason they're beginning to determine that the train never collapsed into the ocean was they realized that Clement Massey was too smart and too educated to have let this work out the way it did. Everything was a ruse.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly. They're going to work it through.
And the reason this wasn't like famous history was because the bank would never admit that it lost $2 million in gold, but the railroad still went bankrupt trying to salvage the train.
Sure. And you would probably kill like a dozen men in the process because that was, it was 1914. They're a dime a dozen. And then after this, they say something funny. They say, he never wore a mask. And that was crazy because everyone would recognize a state senator. No. A state senator could rob me at gunpoint. I would have no earthly idea. They are a faceless mass.
And this is back in the day where you're still running off like really shitty pictures in the newspaper and the newspapers weren't all that great. Or like paintings.
Yes. So it's not like...
You might look nothing like your picture.
You might... Yes, I learned J.P. Morgan had purple... decaying nose.
Oof.
So all the pictures you see of him are like an idealized, touched-up version.
I'm just going to fix that up for you.
So yeah, it was kind of like portraiture was the best you have. Now we have Twitter and instant messaging and phones, camera phones everywhere, and I still couldn't tell you or care to tell you or even pretend to research who my state senator is. It doesn't make a difference. They do nothing.
But we all know who Matt Gaetz looks like.
Ah, oh, yes, we do.
Unfortunately.
Oddly youthful jowls.
What a weird turn of phrase.
But he's got them, youthful jowls. It's disturbing.
Anyway, at this point, Pitt works out the entire plot for the rest of the book, but he has to dole it out bit by bit to people.
Yes. So his first order of business is to call up Sandecker, who's been a really responsible boss at this point, not overworking Pitt at all and being very reasonable with his work-life balance. But to his credit, Pitt calls him up and says, I need a skyhook. This sounds expensive. This sounds really, like, taxpayer-intensive.
Yep.
A skyhook. Oof. And Sandecker's like, you got it. Because what does accountability mean?
Skyhook is just one of those helicopters that can lift, like, 100 tons.
Yes.
But he needs it now.
One of the first memes, the fax memes, about the scuba diver that was taken by Bucket while he was scuba diving and found in a tree because they were putting out forest fires. That was by fax. I received that one by fax in 1998.
I only know that one because we would be on scout hikes and, you know, there'd be like 4, 6, 8 hours of hiking and you have to find some way to pass the time. I guess you would call the game 20 questions, although it would usually take like 10,000. And the one I remember the most that took all of us all day was they found a scuba diver in a tree after a forest fire. How'd he get there?
Oh, for kids, that would be wonderful.
And all you can do is ask yes or no questions. And we're not that smart, so that took us a surprisingly long time to realize that he'd been, you know, scooped up.
It's a lateral thinking puzzle, I guess. And then we go to chapter 67. And Danielle is back with Villon?
Yeah.
After, remember your term, cuck dumped?
I have written down, I guess he wasn't cuck dumped after all.
She's with him and she's walking on eggshells. She's like, you weren't very cordial last time, which is a fucking understatement. He was a psychopath to her. Her standards are, she's the prime minister's wife. She's young. She's beautiful. She apparently has great hair. She should love herself more.
I think this is the first time they've been together since the start of the book. Because the last time they were together, it was fake Villon.
Yes. So as far as she knows, he hates her.
Me too.
It was really cruel. The last time they met, he was like, you mean nothing to me. You never have. I've just used you. And he literally laughed all the way home.
That's just something you do with your side piece.
And you get back together and you just, oh, that's water under the bridge.
Yep. But they're in a private jet that he owns and they drop hints that it was a present from his Moscow associates. And they're just doing loops over Montreal while joining the Mile High Club.
Yes, the largest carbon footprint for sex ever.
Also, it cracks me up because I think this is the first time in the audiobook that Villon acquires an accent. He's read with an accent, but it's like French by way of Russian.
Oh, well, maybe that's only...
Villon sounds very villainous and evil.
Maybe that's only engaged.
But not at all that French.
Accent is only engaged after the Mile High Club has been joined.
Maybe the low oxygen. She says, you weren't yourself last time. And he's like, women are so touchy. I don't remember anything. And they both just move on from Fosk Lie.
Yeah, that would be a hard no for me, Captain. I would have to be throwing this man out of a plane. The only reason to get on a plane with them would be to throw him off of a plane.
They're not very open with their emotion, is what I'm saying.
Meanwhile, while they're on their sex circling plane, Henry Villon walks into the premier's office, the prime minister's office.
Well, while Sarveau is watching TV, it's just like the Guerrier thing. But this is after Sarveau gets a call from the RCMP, where they're like, your wife's on an airplane with Villon. They're just doing loops over Montreal. Thought you might like to know. Bye.
Don't want to be the guy who makes that phone call.
Nope. Henry Villon walks in, and I guess Gly's not dead?
This is where we find out Gly's not dead.
I'm telling you, he's the most interesting Clive Cussler character we've had so far.
And he sounds like a diseased fish get.
I want a Fosk Glive book, because he's everywhere. He's died a few times. He's beat up old man James Bond. He's worked at a gas station. He's recreated Die Hard 2 in a Canadian airport. He's everywhere. He does everything.
Okay, now you're just taunting the cat.
No, she just came up over here and she was messing with the mouse. Come sit on my lap and stop moving. The very end of 67, that's Henry Vallon walks in and asks for a truce, which also doesn't seem like a very Foscoli thing to happen, but whatever.
No, that is not in keeping with his temperament. But he is a psychopath, so that can go everywhere. And the president really only loops people in on a need-to-know basis. And by the time they need to know, they should have known yesterday. So this is how we get the president briefing his security advisor, Mercier. And Mercier is like, what the fuck have you been doing?
Mercier is reading a file that's labeled most secret. And the president wants him to recruit influential Canadians who see things the way I do.
Good luck.
There's some weird politicking happening.
That is some cryptic language. See things the way I do. How would that be, Mr. President, as you employ various people to do bizarre things and you're looking for a treaty like you're shaking out the coins from a couch?
It really sounds kind of coup-like. But the president says, if a miracle happens, we get to design a new flag.
Oh, great. That sounds like a murder. A genocide's going to happen. But new flag, merch.
The world didn't need Canada anymore.
Honestly, it's a nifty-fifty. If we're not going to make it one Dakota, then we're just going to keep it the even 50. Chapter 69, Pitt, Al, and their guy Chase, who's just a wildy coyote kind of figure, they discuss the ghost train that all of them have seen. They, through communication, which these men do surprisingly well at this instance, they all confess to have seen the ghost train.
But that's after we find out what the skyhook was for. The skyhook lowers the doodlebug into the Hudson River.
Oh, yes.
It's
after
back.
We spend $1 billion on the doodlebug being submerged into this river.
An amazing moment of comic genius where they lower the doodlebug into the river, the top of it's sticking out. And then Sam Quayle pops his head out of the doodlebug and says, hey, Pitt, I found another bottle of liquor in here. So he was in there for the whole flight. Sam Quayle rules, too.
Sam Quayle has a drinking problem.
Yes, he does. You have to be in these books.
I know, but alcoholism was so festive back then.
But yeah, then they speed run using the doodlebug back and forth, which can see through 10 miles of solid rock. And they still haven't found the damn train. And you're right, that's where they start talking about the ghost train. And then, like, you saw it? Wait, you saw it? Wait, you saw it too?
Yes, they're all emotionally honest with each other about this subject. It is refreshing. So it's only after they spend a kajillion taxpayer dollars flying the doodlebug by skyhook, which I imagine takes more than a teaspoonful of gas
to
get from point A to point B. And, of course, the epiphanies only happen after you spend a lot of money, which I find to be true. In real life.
Yeah.
I was doing some woodworking last week, and I was like, I'll glue this piece in, because I want, as soon as I glued it in, I'm like, that piece should have never been glued in. What was I thinking?
It's there now forever. Only now do I realize the folly of my ways.
Oh, chapter 70. Chase has a drinking problem, too. He's got his whiskey out, and the three are waiting for the ghost train. The ghost train arrives. Al is like, hey, I'm going to die, but Dirk says, stand here and take it, so I'm going to take it. Al loves Dirk so much.
Not just stand here and take it, but both of you stand here and shut your eyes and plug your ears and stand on the tracks.
It's the worst dare ever.
Well,
Pitt's a bully from middle school.
It's Pitt. He wouldn't do anything stupid.
He has CTE and he hasn't slept in 3 weeks. He might not be trying to do anything stupid, but this sounds like negligent homicide.
The ghost train's getting closer. The ghost train's getting louder. The ghost train's getting brighter. And then Pitt says, now open your eyes. And they open their eyes, and they just see, like, a box go whizzing past with a light on the front that sounds like a train.
So he could have stopped it with a baseball bat.
Yeah. And that's when we realized that it was running along a wire strung on the telegraph poles, because the railway company took out the rails but left up the telegraph poles.
Well, I just thought this was a beautiful yet cruel display of love between Al and Pitt.
Do whatever Pitt says.
And then the three go to Ansel McGee's house. He's the sculptor. We met him earlier.
And we have the Scooby-Doo moment.
He lives in the restored train station. And Pitt's like, hey, we got to talk. And I got to borrow your ghost train and a railway handcar. And McGee's like, you got me. Nobody's ever.
Yeah. It turns out Ansel McGee just made the ghost train for fun because the locals seem to like it.
The locals would see the wires. I've been to Poughkeepsie. They're not blind. It's just over the bridge. I mean, it's normal. They have, like, Starbucks and banks and schools. they're normal people with sight and regular daily functions. They would have looked... You can't Nessie things on wires. If you're going to create a monster, it's got to be better than this. At least give the people of Poughkeepsie some credit. Clive.
It's not a very good Scooby-Doo moment. But then Chapter 71, which is a really long chapter, because they recreate in excruciating detail the robbery from the prologue.
Yes, they do like a dinner theater, almost. Yeah. No dinner, though. Nobody ever eats. No snacks for you.
They recruit Ansel and Annie, who know everything about this robbery.
Well, Ansel knows everything because he's the historian sculptor. Annie's the wife, who's just game for the ride. She's like, ooh, this would be fun. She seems happy to have guests.
I'm just happy to have friends now.
Pitt and Al are there, and Chase is having a vodka in the corner. And they have to reenact the night of the Manhattan Limited, just so Dirk can say, you see, they were fooled by the same thing, because they were all looking the wrong way.
Yeah, and the upshot of it is...
It's angles, buddy. It's angles.
The upshot is Massey robbed the train station just so the two guys who were in the train station wouldn't notice that it wasn't the Manhattan Limited that went by outside. It was just a handcart with a light on the front and, I guess, a Victrola playing train noises. So they thought the train derailed. But all this is to say that Massey just rerouted the train before it even got here. The train was never here. Dun, dun, dun. It's a fake double reverse bank heist.
Just comes down to magicians are really important and we don't pay enough attention to them. In the sleight of hand, they practice, deploy for matters both good and evil. Support your local magician in sleight of hand, which is what this was.
Sleight of train.
A sleight of hand with some bullets. I mean, he did shoot a guy in the hip.
He did shoot some people, yeah. But, you know, kneecapped him like Arnold Schwarzenegger in T2.
But he had athletic awareness. He knew what he had to do. He had to get in there. He had to close the door behind him. So Dapper Don, Dapper Mickey, whatever his name is, state senator, goes in there, slams the door behind him, shoots the chessboard, graces the other guy in the hip, and does so in a way and at a time to make sure they're both looking in the exact wrong direction while he pulls the ace out of a hat.
Not looking out the windows, nothing like that.
Yes, so they get the sensory input, but not the factual input.
This was no regular train robbery, because $2 million in gold coins, they figure out weighs 3 tons. You're not going to just, like, walk away with that. So he had to, like, steal the entire train and stash it somewhere.
Yes, and Dirk is going to find those tracks now that he's pieced that out. And I love that because there are train tracks everywhere.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of research that goes into this. They have to recruit Heidi to go to the train museum and look at all the old maps. They get Pitt up in a helicopter, a VTOL helicopter, because we haven't had enough cool airplanes yet. So we have one of the VTOL aircraft where the wings rotate. It can go straight up and down, vertical takeoff and landing.
Yes.
And they do stereoscopic imaging, which is stuff that my wife had to do in college for forestry, because they do it the exact same way, where you have two pictures of a piece of land that are offset slightly, and you have to look through a stereoscope, so each eye is getting a different angle of the land, so you can see in 3D with two 2D maps.
That's wild, and sounds like it causes cancer.
It doesn't cause cancer, but that was when my wife found out that she can't do that, or she'll throw up.
Oh, yeah.
So she managed to pass that course without using those things, which is impressive.
Yes, it is. Good for her. That is impressive. You get seasick looking through a microscope like that and you can't pass the course. She did it. Good for her.
The whole reason for that is for all of the aerial mapping that they're doing, they can see where the train tracks used to be. They can see the 3D bumps where you would have the rails.
They can see all the detail is raised and put into hyper focus because it's the color is saturated. And they can play with the contrast things. So it is fairly impressive. And you can see that on modern archaeology shows. There's a Time Team on the BBC where they go.
Oh, my God. My wife
in people's backyard.
My wife has seen every episode of Time Team. That was like all she watched for 2 years because that was her go-to relaxation show.
So has my husband. I'm like, they're digging. Oh, good. They found pottery. Oh, they find more pottery tonight. Good. Some clay work. You don't say.
It's so low stakes and pleasant, though.
The way those guys can dig a hole is so meticulous.
It's so perfectly square.
I can only aspire to dig a hole like the way the people on Time Team do. But if you do watch Time Team, they do this photography thing and you can see the land the way Clive Cussler is trying to explain here. You see the dips and valleys and the hidden things. What I'm positing, as a person who lives near to where this location is supposed to be, is there's train tracks and abandoned train tracks and railroads that were put down that never had a train put on them because the guy went broke. Miscellaneous train tracks because it only belonged to one business and it just was, you know, doing a loop around a town. Good luck finding a particular... It's a needle in a haystack and there's hay everywhere.
Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure our heroes will find it because they're the main characters of this book. All right, let's zip through a couple of chapters here because this is already going to be a long episode.
Okay, just one note. Heidi got a phone call while she was... Oh, yeah, 71. They do the whole recap, the bank robbery thing, misdirection. Mm-hmm. 72, the Cuban trade embargo was lifted in 1985, as we learned in this universe.
Yep.
Clive went out on a limb. Didn't work out this time. I respect it.
I wrote, yeah, right for that. But all that was to explain why Sandecker prefers Honduran cigars to Cubans.
And we learned that Sean and Heidi are having some sex time in a hotel because she really hates having a career or any kind of clout.
Heidi's in a bath with her busted leg sticking out of it. Shaw pours some champagne on her and gives her the phone.
Yes. And Shaw eavesdrops on her conversation with Sandecker and gets all of the details. I'm shocked. How could he violate her privacy so?
Sandecker wants her to go to the train archives and start doing research because she is their go-to research person.
So Shaw overhears this, calls the front desk, arranges an escape call. Anybody who's been on a blind date knows what an escape call is. It's like, call me in 5 minutes and, you know, tell me my stove's on fire. I gotta get out of here. And he goes to Long Island. From wherever he is, they don't say, I presume they're not on Long Island. They're near Poughkeepsie. So they are all over the place. Time means nothing to Clive with commutes. He respects nobody. These people are traveling for hours. And he goes to the Long Island Museum and pretends, Long Island Railroad Museum, and pretends to be an FBI agent.
It's late, and the guy's like, eh, you're probably FBI, sure. Anyway, here's all the archives. I'm going to go over here and not pay attention to you for a few minutes. And Shaw just steals everything.
Yes. Museum guy's like, grumpy, grumpy, grumpy. I'll get you some coffee. He comes back. Shaw's disappeared. And the next day, more FBI come. And this guy's like, oh, this has been a busy week.
And Heidi realizes that she was backstabbed yet again and realizes exactly what happened when, like, Shaw had to go for a couple hours. Then Shaw came back to the hotel room and made fluid and gentle love.
Oh,
which is a wonderful sentence.
It sounds moist.
And then there's just, in the middle of this, like, Heidi is in the train archives, realizing she's backstabbed again, and we get, like, 15 straight paragraphs of her comparing Shaw and Pitt as lovers. And specifically talking about Brian Shaw was caring and thoughtful and tender. And these are some quotes. Making love to Dirk Pitt, who drowned her, exhausted her, defeated her, and reminded her who was superior. Pitt left her feeling spent and used, and she's, like, feeling all warm and cozy about this.
I think Clive has some deep issues around intimacy that he is working out through these books. I'm glad he's got a medium.
That's how men do it, damn
to
it.
To express himself.
Apparently.
I hope he found love that didn't hurt sometime in his life.
Heidi has a great idea, and she, rather than looking at maps, she looks at the dispatch logs from 1914.
Yes, she...
She is smart.
She imagines Shaw's like, oh, I've got her cornered. There's nothing she can do. And she's like, you jackass.
Oh, no, you don't. I'm smarter than you,
I just
dumbass.
Vaporized my career, but I'm really smart.
You sly, brutish 70-year-old bastard.
Sexy and live, 70-year-old bastard.
Yes. Chapter 74, 24 hours to go. We are on a ticking clock with every chapter now.
Yeah. Heidi, Al, and Pitt are all together again. And they are looking for the Mondragon Hook. It's through the dispatches she's realized this old rail spur was around, and it's near a quarry, and she has some identifying characteristics, and they have the film footage that they're going over, and they find the spur. They find the hidden spur that goes to the quarry, and now they're en route to the quarry.
Because it had to be a siding that's no longer there. It had to be a siding that led underground, because where are you going to hide a train while you rob it of 3 tons of gold over a period of weeks? Where would you hide a train that it was never found even until now? And they go through a whole lot of history, blah, blah, blah. Heidi confesses that Brian Shaw knows everything, and then everybody realizes, oh, God, she slept with Shaw again. But they move past
She
it
didn't
quickly.
Have to say, I would have made up a lie.
he tapped my phone. Yeah, that's what happened.
He snuck into my room. I only realized after... Try, lady, try. She's on her own in this world. There's no other income that's going to come and save her. She's facing homelessness and destitution.
But at the end of this chapter, we have 19 hours to go now, but they know where to go. They know where the siding used to be. They know that the train with the treaty is inside this mountain.
Yes, the treaty is inside the mountain, and everybody's going to the mountain now. It's going to be a party. Shaw's dropping in Halo style.
This book is six books in one.
So Shaw and his crew all parachute in and kind of bump into each other. And he doesn't even know who these people are. And they're like, are you Shaw? Should I shoot you? And rightfully, he's like, oh, no, I'm Shaw. And then...
That's why you don't skip rehearsal.
Pank goes to... That rehearsal dinner was not meant to be brought up on air. I told you that in private.
So you shot your last co-host.
And during this time, Shaw sees Pitt, and he considers shooting him. He's like, I'll let him go.
Yeah.
He's a tiger.
We're friends.
I'm a tiger. We have to respect. And that's where we should end it, because good God, we're almost at the end, but I give up for right now.
Yeah, my brain is shot. All right, I'm going to be out of town for most of this week, but I'm going to make sure that I read to the end. I get all my notes, and we can finish this sucker off next week.
Yes, listeners, we have about 3 pages left, but we've lost the will to live. And we will see you next week. We love you, especially New Zealand. Goodbye, New Zealand.
Thank you, New Zealand. Good night.
This has been Kustler Hustlers. Your hosts have been Topper and Nancy. Find us on Twitter and Instagram at Kustler Hustlers.